And welcome. It is Your Money. I want to remind you right out of the gate, if you have a question for Bruce or Peg, you can call 651-461-9226. And we would like you to call in and ask anything of Bruce and Peg. Now here, once again, is the founder of Wealth Enhancement, Bruce Helmer, and Senior Vice President Peg Webb with Wealth Enhancement to take your calls and your texts. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Peg Webb. Good morning, Susie Jones. Good morning, listeners. And yeah, it's a open line show.
Nice.
We get to ask Peg anything. I'll probably ask Peg some questions and learn from Peg also. And like Susie said, no specific topic today. Any question is fair game. Doesn't even have to be financial. If you want to talk about the Timberwolves, we can talk about that if you want to. Hey, Peg, what are you hearing right now from clients? Before we get, you know, listeners involved, are there any specific things that you're hearing consistently from clients and prospects or people when you're out and about talking to people in the world?
You know, Bruce and Susie, I would say generally everybody's happy. They're still happy because the markets have done really well and interest rates are still high. So when you look at the combination of your growth side of your portfolio and your fixed income side of your portfolio, I have to tell you, people are happy. Now, it is an election year, and so there's more questions. It always happens. I mean, we've been doing this, Bruce, for decades, and it's kind of a repeat. Every time we have an election, every time we have an election, it just heightens people's anxiety a little bit, and they try to relate that to the stock market. History has shown us, and I don't know that that's what's going to happen in the future, but history has shown us that really and truly, markets don't necessarily favor one political party historically. They just haven't. And we have to just remember that markets represent companies, specifically like that we're looking at the future probability of companies. And I've always, always been optimistic in the long term. I don't look at the very short term because that is when the volatility happens, and we can't, Bruce, guide people on 30-day, 60-day, six-month, you know, views. We have to just make sure that people have enough in their safe buckets, you know, if they're taking income. And if you have a long-term perspective, that just means that if you look at the past, once again, you can't, it's not necessarily the future, but our job gets a little hard when people, you know, ask us, oh, the market's so high, maybe I should sell everything today. And I think we've done a really good job over the decades keeping people, you know, stable so that they have the money to repair or have future income for the rest of their lives. Bruce?
Yeah, Peg, I don't disagree with what you said in terms of people being happy. I think I experienced some of that also. But I'm also glad you brought up the fact that it's a presidential election year, because I am getting, you know, those questions or those concerns. And again, we've become so politicized as a country, and we've become so divisive. And I really think it's sad, you know, whether you're Republican or a Democrat or an independent or a conservative or a liberal or whatever you call yourself, we're all Americans. We all want what's best for America. And we may not always agree what the best path is to get there, but that doesn't make us enemies. But for some reason today it does. And then that affects how people think about money and their 401k plan. And if the wrong party gets power, the sky is falling and things are going to be awful. And you're right. The data, the historical data, just does not bear that out. I just do not personally, as an investor myself, get nervous about presidential election years. But the other thing I wanted to touch on, Peg, and again, my sense is the people I'm talking to are generally happy or optimistic, but I know that the polling data, there's a lot of people still struggling. You know, you mentioned the high interest rates, which are great for savers, But that's a two-edged sword, right? So for people that want to buy a house or people that are have to borrow, those high interest rates are detrimental. And inflation, reared its ugly head the last couple of years. Things cost more at the grocery store, and consumers are feeling the effects. And the polling data suggests that one reason why the polling is close and President Biden is vulnerable is that people are not in favor of the way the economy has been going. They're feeling the crunch of inflation. Their wages maybe they've gone up, but maybe not at the same rate that inflation has. So I know that statistically that's out there, but those are, for whatever reason, not the people that I'm talking to or encountering. And I just don't, I mean, what do you think about that broader question? I mean, again, I'm not saying that your lead in that people are happy. I'm not saying I disagree, but I think, there's also people that are still struggling because of the high inflation rate. Yes, Peg?
Yeah. One of the things we should mention is that the clients that I work with and the clients that are at Wealth Enhancement Group as a whole, they have money, right? So we're managing their money. We're guiding them through their financial life. And so I wanted to mention that because you asked me how my clients are reacting to that. But in the world or, in other areas, I have to agree with you. People are struggling. And the cost of things, especially groceries, which, are just astronomical compared to what they used to be, and families, trying to live within the wages that they have, they're struggling out there. So the people that can actually invest in treasuries and municipal bonds and those kinds of things are just happy that finally they're making money on their money, and knowing that really that inflation is there, you might be only netting, 2% on your 5% treasury or something, but we feel better that we're getting that money. So I would agree with you, Bruce, and, you and I have gone through so many election years, and the point I wanted to make is don't focus on that. Make sure that you revisit your financial plan and you feel good about it, longer term, and even in the shorter term, to make sure that you're positioned well. But we've seen, we've seen the market swing thousands of points after somebody was elected, and then the very next day it just turned around again. So I don't want people to get out of the market thinking that they could time when they get back in, because I still believe that that's impossible. Bruce.
Yeah, and there's overwhelming data that trying to time the market, trying to outguess or outthink the market does not work. You will shoot your toes off if you try to do that. Your long-term money should stay exposed to stocks. Your short-term money should not be in stocks, never should have been in stocks. If it was, get it out of there if it's short-term money. But long-term money stays in stocks. We don't know what stocks will do in the short term, but history tells us historically in the long term, stocks generally outperform other asset classes. And again, before we get listeners, one quick one I wanted to hit you with, Peg. I'm also getting a lot of questions about taxes and tax law changes, and we've talked about it a little bit on the show. The taxes are on sale right now, but the current tax law that passed in, I think, 2017 will sunset at the end of 2025. And if Congress doesn't do anything, taxes will go back to the pre-2017 rates. Is that something that we should be talking to people about? Is that something you're talking to your clients about?
Yeah, it's pretty dramatic, and we've been talking about this for a couple years now, too, whereby there isn't a high percentage of people that this matters to. But if there's a certain amount of money that we can die with without having to pay an estate tax, like an additional tax, and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act said, oh, we're going to raise the exemption. And right now it's $13.61 million apiece. You know, so we've got a lot of room there that we don't have to worry about. But the big point being is that in January of 2026, it's going to drop to $7 million apiece. So the people that have been, you know, huge savers, have a lot of wealth, you know, those are the people that this really matters to and that are watching it closely, and which is, you know, some of our clients. Susie, do we have a call and texters for questions?
Yes, we do. We have a call at 651-461-9226. Let's go to Al. Al's been waiting to ask you both questions. Hello, Al.
Hi.
Thanks for being part of the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been pretty lucky. If I were to give a gift of money to my son on June 1, would I also be able to give a gift of money on January 1? As long as I'm staying below the $18,000, is there a tax consequence?
Hey, Al, thanks for listening, and thanks for a great question. So, Peg, Al's got a question about giving, and he knew that the amount is $18,000 in terms of how much you can give to someone without a tax consequence. But can he do it in June, then turn around and do it again in January?
Yeah, so the simple answer is yes, because it is on a calendar year. So you're correct in that 2024 lifetime gift exemption is $18,000. And what that means is you can give $18,000 to anybody you want to give, and it's really unlimited. If you want to give to 100 people, $18,000 in 2024. But then it starts all over again on January 1st of 2025, and you can gift $18,000. Why this is a big deal is because you don't have to fill out you know, a bunch of forms and notify the IRS that you've gifted this money. You do, however, if you go over that $18,000, and mind you, if you're a married couple, you can give $36,000 to a recipient. But if you go over that amount, what you need to do is you have to file a form with the IRS just alerting them that you did this. There's no tax to be paid at the time, but they're going to take that off of your $13 million number that I talked about, $13.6 million that you can give in a lifetime. So it's more of an organization thing where you need to document. But the good news is for you is that it's by calendar year. So, Bruce?
Yeah, calendar year or tax year, same thing. And you're right, Peg. Al can give to anybody he wants. And Al, if you felt so inclined, there's one Ellen Helmer, if you make a check out to me, H-E-L-M-E-R, I'm kidding. But the other thing, Peg, you mentioned, it's $18,000, you know, per year per person without any, you know, fuss or muss or extra effort. But you can gift as much as you want. You're not limited to $18,000, but then it's a little bit more work if you go over that number. But it's $18,000 per year per person. So if Al is married, and usually when we see this gifting, it's to kids, right? In my experience, it's adults helping or parents helping their adult children. But Al could give $18,000 to his child, and his wife could give $18,000 to their child. And if their child is married, they can each give $18,000 to their child's spouse. So it literally could be $72,000 from one family to another without any extra effort or tax considerations. Now, I'm not saying everybody out there can afford to do that, but that's how much they actually could do legally if they had the economic wherewithal to do so. So thanks for listening, Al. Thanks for the question. Susie, more questions?
Yeah, 651-461-9226. Remember, you can call that line or you can text that line, as we just heard from Al. Question from a listener. Now that I'm 65, can I use my HSA dollars on anything? Bruce, Peg?
Peg, HSA health savings accounts and just for clarity for listeners that don't know, these are accounts that are available to people that have a high deductible insurance plan. You and I advocate these HSAs all the time for people that are eligible that have a high deductible health insurance plan, because they're like a supercharged IRA on steroids. You get a deduction for the contribution like you do on a traditional IRA, but you can take tax-free withdrawals for qualifying healthcare expenses like a Roth IRA. So you get to have your cake and eat it too. You get a deduction and you get tax-free withdrawals. And so these are very efficient, very popular tools for people that are eligible. But as you start going into Medicare and age 65, the rules get tricky, and I got to be honest, I sometimes get confused also. So what? They're 65 now. How does an HSA work when you hit age 65, Peg?
Yeah, typically you would use those for qualified medical expenses. So the pot of money that you've contributed to, and you've probably earned money on that money over the years, you have to use it for qualified medical expense. Now, you can go spend that money on anything you want. You could go buy a car if you want to. The negative of that is it's then going to be taxable. So if you it's kind of like an IRA, right? You're going to take the money out of your HSA, health savings account, and you're going to have to put that on your income tax and pay your tax rates, both federal and Minnesota. But they do allow the flexibility of taking that money if that's what you need, to buy your car or whatever you need. So just keep in mind that you need to use it for qualified medical expenses, and then it's a tax-free distribution. Bruce?
The other thing I would just add really quickly, and this is, again, one of the things that make this such an efficient, attractive thing to put money into. So a lot of times, Peg, people ask me, so the texter asked about what can I spend it on at 65? But a lot of times I get the question from people in their 50s or they haven't retired yet, and they're like, when do I use my HSA? I went to the doctor for this, I went to the doctor for that. And most people, and there's no right or wrong answer here, but most people pay the little stuff out of their pocket. They don't tap into their HSA. They're kind of saving their health savings account for a big ticket item. But let's say you pay for any number of things over the years out of your own pocket. Document that. I actually keep a manila file folder full of all of my medical expenses that I'm paying out of my pocket, not using my HSA, because you can actually, if you never hit that quote-unquote big ticket item, I can go back and reimburse myself with a tax-free withdrawal from my HSA for all those things I paid out of my own pocket over the years, as long as I can document it. So these are very, very efficient, it's a very powerful strategy, but again, it's only applicable to somebody that has a high deductible health insurance plan. But in my experience, Peg, many people that are eligible either aren't using it or aren't putting as much into it as I wish they would.
Bruce, I have a question about HSAs. Are they a good idea for everyone, even if you have traditional insurance through your company?
Yeah, Peg, again, assuming you have a high deductible plan. And some people, Susie, should not have a high deductible plan, because if they have kids or teenage drivers, or you have health issues where you go to the doctor a lot, you shouldn't have a high deductible plan. But Peg, wouldn't you say anybody that's on a high deductible plan is a good candidate for a health savings account?
Yeah, I do, because with high deductible plans, we have to pay a lot out of pocket, right, to get to that bogey, if you will, when you get more medical paid for yourself. So the idea of it was for that money that you have for this high deductible plan, that you have this bogey, was that here you can put money into this tax-free account, and technically you could take it right back out to pay for your deductibles that you need to reach, that cap. So I like to choose to hold my HSA and earn money on that money, so it gets to be a bigger pot, for when I'm older. But they're quite flexible, so that's why I'm a big fan of them.
Bruce, we have about a minute left, but another question about HSAs from the text line, 651-461-9226. Can HSA money be used for a nursing home or home care?
Oh, gosh, Peg. Yeah, Peg, health savings accounts and long-term care facilities. What's the connection? How does that work?
You know, I have never taken money out of a HSA for long-term care, but as long as it's a qualified medical expense, and you'd have to look at all the listing of items that the IRS says it's okay to use your HSA for, but I would think you could. I'd have to look that one up. I haven't coached people on that recently.
All right. 651-461-9226. That is the number that you can call or you can text, and we have a number of text questions coming in. We have about 30 seconds, Bruce and Peg. Maybe we could just take our break now and come back with more of these questions, some about HSAs as we continue the conversation. Want to remind people listening, it is your money. This is your chance to call 651-461-9226. You can also text us questions at 651-461-9226. We're back after this short break. It is your money, and it is your chance to ask Bruce or Peg anything that is on your mind. Bruce says he'll take anything, even non-money questions. But we do have an open line here for you to call at 651-461-9226, and you can call or text. We have a couple of callers on the line, though, guys. So let's start with Bert. Bert is calling with a question for you both. Hello, Bert. Thanks for being part of the program.
Yes, thank you. About 40 years ago, my father was in an investment club, and they invested in a utility called Philadelphia Electric. Well, since then, it's changed to a company called Exelon. When my father passed away, it went into my mother's name, who passed away maybe a couple years after that. Now it's in my name. How do I determine capital gains when I sell it?
Hey, Bert, thanks for listening, and that's a really intriguing question. Peg, I've seen this before, too, where, a company changes names or it's acquired multiple times and or it's passed on from one family member to another. And, you know, the heart of Bert's question is, if I sell the stock, what's my basis, what's my gain, and how much do I actually have to pay taxes on? And it can be really tricky to know that basis if you're looking at over a 40-year history of multiple company changes, name changes, acquisitions, passed on ownership from one family member to another. How in the heck does Bert figure out what his basis is and what his gain is to pay the taxes if he sells the stock?
Yeah, where I would start is there still is what's called a step up in basis. So when you inherit a stock, it will step up to the date of death value. So that saves a lot of time and research and that kind of thing. What happens, though, is a lot of times when people inherit a stock, they hold the stock. So then the time after the date of death, you know, you have this step up in basis, but then now you want to sell the stock, let's say 10 or 20 years later. How do you find the information that you need? One way is if you can find that date of death value, that would be helpful. The other thing is dividends. If it's a dividend paying stock, you may have decided to take those dividends along the way and you've already paid tax on that. So you still have just the original value of the data. If you're reinvesting the dividends, then each one of those reinvestments into the stock is another calculation to figure out what the capital gains is going to be. So this is not an easy task by any means, and we've helped so many clients get through this. But a lot of times there's a transfer agent, you know, someone that is in charge of talking to shareholders and communicating with them how many sometimes people have the stock in book entry, where the transfer agent would know then how many shares you have and how many dividends have paid since you've had it. So that's a little highlight there. You can find the transfer agent and talk to them. Sometimes it's the most difficult thing that you have to do. So you kind of have to do the best efforts, you know, to try to find what that basis would be over time. And that's possible because we have a history on a particular stock for a very long time. And so maybe you're not going to have it to the penny or to the dollar, but best efforts is the most intelligent thing that you can do if you don't find the data that you need. Bruce?
Yeah, that's such a good answer, Peg. In fact, as I was thinking in my head what I was going to add when you were done, then you went there, and so you gave a very thorough answer. I'll just pick up the baton a little bit, you know, with regard to best efforts. That's what I tell people also. And a lot of listeners might not understand, if I own this stock and every time they declare a dividend, I don't take it in cash and it buys more shares of the stock, essentially that's the same as if I wrote a check and it increases my basis and it reduces the amount of my gain when I sell the stock. But it's hard to figure out what that number is. So you make your best effort and you pay what you think you're supposed to pay and you file your taxes. And if the IRS audits you and they want to challenge it, let them try to prove that you're wrong. But all you can do is say, look, I did my best. I don't know if it's right to the penny, but I tried. And you tell me where I got it wrong, if I got it wrong. So, sometimes it may not be possible to calculate that answer to the penny. And I love, and that's exactly the same expression I use, best efforts. Give it your best shot, make your best effort. That's all you can do. What else can you do? Right. Susie?
Yeah, 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. If you have a question for Bruce or Peg, we have Joe on our newsline next. Joe, go ahead. You're on with Bruce and Peg.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a disabled veteran, but while I was working, I had a high deductible health care plan, and they tried to tell me I couldn't contribute to my HSA because of getting some of my health care at the VA. And I was wondering if you could explain that to me or straighten it out.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your question. And most importantly, thank you for your service to our country. Again, I've said this many times. I've said it on this show. I've said it a lot of places. As a country, I'm not sure we show the proper appreciation for our veterans. And thank you for your service. Peg, I got to plead ignorance here in terms of, you know, veterans benefits and you know, the way things work with VA, HSA and VA. I'm not sure I can give Joe any help. Can you help us out?
No. So one of the things we do know with the VA is that when it comes to questions around what they're doing, how you qualify, how you're not allowed to do these things, it comes up often. It does. But then I would go to our roundtable and ask for specifics on that because there, quite frankly, there isn't a high percentage of people that come with VA questions. But yet we have the knowledge within our entire team, and we can certainly go research that and maybe come back next week, Bruce.
Yeah, we can either, if we think of it and remember, we can either address it on the show next week or Joe, if you, and again, I try not to say this. I never wanted to be a radio show that says, well, call us Monday morning, but I'm going to say call us Monday morning because if you pose that question, I think that with research, we have people that can give you that answer, but I certainly didn't know it off the top of my head. I was hoping Peg would, and sorry to let you down, Joe, but if you give us a shout, in fact, you can even ask for me if you want to, but and Peg, if we get somebody to help us, maybe we can even address it on the radio show next week. Susie?
Yes, and just to let Joe know, that number to call your office is 888-6-ADVICE. And maybe if you're still on the line, Joe, Charlie can help get that number for you as well to call on Monday. 651-461-9226. Let's take this question from a texter. When it comes to RMDs, what accounts will the distribution be taken from? What accounts will the distribution be taken from?
So, Susie and listeners, the texter saying RMD, they're talking about required minimum distributions. These are the legal obligation that when you have a traditional tax-deferred account, like a traditional IRA or a traditional 401k, once you reach a certain age, Uncle Sam is basically saying, look, we gave you a deduction for the contribution to that account. We gave you the ability to defer taxes. You didn't get you haven't paid any taxes along the way, all the years of growth. But once you reach a certain age, we're going to mandate or insist that you start to take withdrawals so we can collect taxes on that money. It's a required minimum distribution. Peg, you want to add more detail to RMDs?
Yeah, thanks, Bruce, for clarifying the required minimum distribution, because it can be a little bit tricky, especially because Congress has changed the age that people are mandatorily have a mandatory distribution. Used to be 70 and a half, and then there was a couple different iterations, and now it's 73, and it's going as high as 75 in upcoming years. In the very beginning, when this required minimum distribution started, we actually had to take money out of each individual IRA, and what a pain that was. So let's say you have, you know, a fixed income account and you have a stock account, but you really wanted to take all your required minimum distribution from the stock account because the market was doing so well. We didn't have a choice. We had to take a percentage out of each. They changed that quite some time ago, where you get to decide where do you want to take your required minimum distribution from. So lots of clients, including at Wealth Enhancement Group, we set up kind of different buckets of money, and they're all IRAs. So let's say you have three different IRAs. You can choose where you want to take that required minimum distribution from. You can take it from just one account, you could take it from two accounts, or you could take it from all three if that's what you want to do. But I love the flexibility of us and clients being able to decide where they take the money out, which makes sense for them, maybe given what the markets are doing, both on the fixed income side and the growth side. Bruce?
Yeah, Peg, you know, and that's a great answer. And again, just to elaborate a little further, you have to add all the IRAs together to get the total aggregate value, and it's really based on the December 31st value of those accounts on the year before you have to take your distribution. But once we get that total aggregate value, Peg is absolutely correct. You have to add all those together to figure out what your RMD is, but you can take it out of only one account. And I'm proud to tell everybody listening, and I think this is a huge value added for people, at Wealth Enhancement, our clients, all of them, I'd say, don't worry about your RMD. We will be proactive. Once we will calculate your RMD number as early in the year as we can. Then we'll reach out to you and tell you what that number is, and then we'll tell you what account or accounts we think you should take it from, so you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to, you know, fret over it. You don't have to do a lot of work. We'll do all the work for you and tell you what you need to do, and I'm proud of that, and I think it's a huge value added. Hey, Peg, before we go back to callers and questions, I think you wanted to go back and hit something on long-term care.
Yeah, the long-term care, there was a question about, can I use it for my health savings account? Can I take a distribution tax-free? Well, one thing I just want to remind everybody is Wealth Enhancement Group works as a huge team, and we have this thing called the roundtable. And the reason we have the roundtable specialists in all these different areas is because one person, one advisor can't know it all. So it takes a village and it takes a team to be able to assist our clients on a daily basis. But here I got a message from one of our roundtable people while on break, and they said, hey, remember? And I went, oh, that's right. So number one, you can take your premiums that you pay for your long-term care expenses. I kind of forgot about this one. I have several clients who are taking their premiums out of their health savings account. And then secondly, you actually can use your health savings account for facilities like assisted living, memory care, skilled nursing, through long-term care insurance. So I thank our roundtable for coming back and answering that so we could get the folks that answer today.
Thank you for circling back on that. I think that was important to get that detail. And I got to be honest, I thought that was the answer, but I wasn't confident enough to say it. So I'm glad somebody on the roundtable jumped in and helped us out. Susie?
651-461-9226. You can call that line and talk to Bruce and Peg directly, or you can text it. A lot of people prefer that. 651-461-9226. Mark has been waiting on the phone to talk to you folks. Go ahead, Mark. You're on with Peg and Bruce.
Yeah, Peg and Bruce, this is my first year collecting Social Security. Now, do I have to pay federal income taxes and state income tax if my combined Social Security and investment income combined is less than $25,000? Do I have to pay income tax federal and state on that?
Hey, Mark, thanks for listening. Thanks for a great question. And this is going to be, Peg, something that we can expand for the audience because it's impactful to almost everybody. If they're not drawing Social Security now, they probably will be at some point in time. Talk about how Social Security is taxed.
Yeah, so Social Security comes out with a kind of a guideline, if you will, and it's based on your filing status. So if you're a single person, and I think that maybe, Mark, that's what you're talking about, because you mentioned $25,000. So they have bogeys, if you will, that if you're under that particular bogey, then you actually pay zero. Now, for a married filing jointly that's under $32,000, that the amount subject to tax is zero. Well, how this works is, and then there's different tiers, how this works is you take your Social Security, and then you actually pay tax on 85% of that Social Security. Why said 85%? I have no idea. Maybe just for some additional confusion. But 85% literally flows onto then your taxable column. Then you also have other income, adjusted gross income, which actually includes municipal bonds and some things that maybe aren't tax-free. You have to add all of that other income in to stay under that $25,000. Now that, in my experience over decades of time, is very hard to get under. Now you can, you know, before your, you know, RIA, RMDs start kicking in, or, you know, you have some additional income that might come in down the road. Where I see people being able to do it is if you retire early and you haven't taken Social Security. and you can spend cash in the bank, right? Then you start taking Social Security and you're still using some of that cash in the bank. You could probably stay under if you don't have a lot of dividends and things come off of your bank accounts and, you know, your stocks and that kind of thing. So it's hard to get to those bogeys under that bogey. And then there's a second tier up to 50% of your Social Security, and then it's up to 85%. But once again, Bruce, I have a hard time seeing people that can get that low. Bruce?
Yeah, Mark kind of answered his own question in a way. He knew the, you know, if he stayed below $25,000, he didn't have to pay tax, or he thought that was the case, and he confirmed it with us. But I agree with you, Peg. I seldom see anybody that's able to stay that low because there's so many sources of income. Even like you said, municipal bonds. I've had people argue with me before and say, well, I don't have to count that. It's tax-free. And I'm like, you're not paying taxes on your tax-free munis, but that is part of your, what the IRS calls provisional income, and it does add to the total that you have to report when you determine whether or not you're going to pay taxes on your Social Security benefit and how much. So you did a great job, though, of explaining it or giving clarity or a better, longer answer to Mark's original question. Susie, can we squeeze one more in today?
Yeah, sure, we'll try. This texter writes, where is the best place to put $50,000 to $75,000 for 6 to 10 months to earn the best interest? Is there a place?
Pick 6 to 10 months, $50,000 to $75,000. What would you do, or what would you advise?
Well, right now, we can still get 5% or more on 6 to 10 month investments. And there's a couple things. You can go to the bank and see what rates of interest they pay. You can look at money market accounts, which money market accounts, many of those are over 5%. And then, or you could go buy an individual treasury bond that's paying more than 5%. That's actually maybe more of a pain to set up an account to buy a treasury for that short term. But I would say somewhere between, you know, talking to your bank or looking at money markets, those are the best, or, you know, the best rates of interest today. Bruce?
Yeah, and I would only add, because of the time horizon in question, I would not expose it to stocks. I would not put it in the stock market. And Big, I know some people think you and I always want people to go on the stock market, but not for short-term money. I've talked people out of giving me money before if the time horizon was too short and I didn't think stocks were appropriate. So I agree with everything Peg said. I would only add, if you've never looked at online banking, and I know some people just aren't going to go down that road, but I am technologically one of the dumbest technological people you'll ever meet. And even I figured out how to go online and open up an online account, and I can get that my online bank is paying me a higher interest rate than my local, you know, banking accounts here. So look at online banks, look at 6 month, 9 month CDs. Peg's right. You should be able to get 5% or more without taking market risk. Susie, I think we're about out of time.
Well, how about it? That was a great show, guys. A lot of great questions. Thanks, everybody, for being part of the show. Can we squeeze this in? What is the age of RMD? Isn't it required? Distribution, do you have to take it out at some age?
Yeah, for most people right now it's 73.
Okay,
but that's going to be ramping up, so some people actually, by the time they get there, it'll be as high as 75, but right now the short answer is 73.
Thank you very much. That one was for me. Squeezed it in. If you did not get your question answered, please email them. They will answer it for you. yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Again, that's yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. That is the email to send. If you want to call, you can do that as well. 1-888-6-ADVICE. Make it a great day.